This is Ahval Online, meeting point of accurate news and free comment on the current affairs of Turkey. Welcome to our podcast series.
Hello. Turkish President Recep Tayyip Erdogan is coming up to the end of his second term as President of Turkey. Technically, this should be his last term, but of course things aren't that simple. Today we're looking at Turkey's constitution and whether it allows President Erdogan to run for a third term in office. Welcome to Made in Turkey. I'm John. This is a podcast for Ahval about Turkish politics, society, and so on. Now, looking at the constitution of Turkey without any kind of background information whatsoever would be like jumping into the deep end when you can't swim. I always remember in one of Charlie Brooker's screen wipes, he said that watching the news was like coming into the 5,000th episode of like the most longest-running soap opera you've ever seen and not knowing who any of the characters are. So I think one of the things that could make talking about the constitution of Turkey a bit more interesting is looking at the historical background of the constitution, how it intersects with things that have happened in Turkish history and how we've got to the point where we are today. So the way I'm going to structure this podcast today is that I'll start off by looking at a longer-term view of Turkish constitutional history, starting from the first constitution of 1876. And for that, I'll be using Eric Zurch's book, Turkey in Modern History, which is a pretty straightforward summary of the last 300 years of Turkish history, which I would recommend if you are interested in that longer background of Turkish history. And then I'm going to be talking to Emre Turkut, who is a PhD candidate from the University of Ghent and an expert in Turkish law. And we'll be looking at the current state of the Turkish constitution, what changes to it might be possible, and whether Turkey's President Recep Tayyip Erdogan would make any changes in order to run for a third term as president, and whether it's possible to make those changes given the constraints of the constitution. But before we get into constitutional history, maybe it might be a good idea to start off with reading a little bit of the actual constitution of Turkey. Rather than having me read it, I would like to have it read by the author of the Virtuous American podcast, who appears to be a very nationalistic American man, whose entire podcast is largely him reading out the constitutions of various countries, interspersed with some short segments where he says how great America is. So, anyway, here's him reading the Constitution of Turkey.
This is the Constitution of Turkey. This constitution, which affirms the eternal existence of the Turkish homeland and nation and the indivisible integrity of the Grand Turkish State, is entrusted for safekeeping by the Turkish nation to the patriotism and nationalism of its democracy-loving sons and daughters, is to be understood, interpreted, and implemented by its ideas, beliefs, and determination in deference and with absolute loyalty to its letter and spirit. In the direction of the concept of nationalism as defined by Atatürk, the founder of the Republic of Turkey, the immortal leader and the unrivaled hero, and his reforms and principles, in the direction of the eternal existence, prosperity, and material and spiritual well-being, and the determination to attain to the level of contemporary civilization of the Republic of Turkey, as an honorable member with equal rights of the family of the world nations, in recognition of the absolute supremacy of the will of the nation, whereby sovereignty is vested fully and unconditionally in the Turkish nation, and no person or institution authorized to exercise it on behalf of the nation can deviate from liberal democracy set forth in this constitution and the legal system prescribed according to its requirements.
The first constitution of Turkey was written in 1876, but only lasted less than a year before being thrown out by Sultan Abdulhamid II, who thought it put some annoying restrictions on his power. The constitution came about as a result of a palace coup by European-influenced constitutionalists who felt that the Ottomans were falling dangerously behind other world powers and needed to modernize. They installed Sultan Murat V. Former Sultan Abdulaziz committed suicide, an army officer then assassinated some of the members of the Ottoman cabinet, Murat became an alcoholic and had a nervous breakdown, leaving his brother Hamit to be installed as the new Sultan Abdulhamit II. That's all exact, like, 1 month in 1876. A lot happened then. Immediately after this, Serbia rebelled against the Ottomans. A conference was held to sort out the Balkan mess, which failed, and then Russia invaded, forcing a humiliating defeat on the Ottomans. Serbia, Montenegro, Bulgaria, and Romania all became independent. Russia took Kars in the northeast of Turkey. It since was given back to the Turkish Republic at the end of the First World War. Austria took Bosnia, and Britain somehow snuck in and took Cyprus because, of course, Britain did. It's just like, I don't know, it's like the 5% that Britain got off the top of the deal for, you know, being the big mediator. It's like, oh yeah, and we'll just have Cyprus as well. No one was really doing anything with it, so. But I think, you know, it was one of those deals where Britain was like, yeah, we're just holding this for you. Like, we're just being this sort of, like, security guarantor power. We don't really, like, control you or anything. With the Russian army almost at the gates of Istanbul, Abdulhamit prorogued parliament indefinitely in February 1878. By 1908, Abdulhamit was getting old and increasingly autocratic, and the young Western-influenced officers of the army were getting frustrated again. The Committee for Union and Progress, or Young Turk movement, had grown out of a young Ottoman movement in the previous constitutional period, and they were again alarmed at the diminishment of Ottoman power and the loss of Balkan territories. The CUP believed that the restoration of the constitution would be the only way to keep the various national groups in the empire together and prevent further fragmentation. New elections were held, and the parliament reconvened, but the Sultan retained a lot of power. After a counter-revolution against the CUP in 1909, the CUP deposed the Sultan, replacing him with his younger brother, Mehmet V, and reducing the power of the Sultan to the appointment of the vizier and religious head of the empire. All citizens were also required to perform military service, with the result that many Greeks started to leave Anatolia. Before this period, there were a lot of concessions for the various millets, the various national groups within the Ottoman Empire that were sort of guaranteed by various European imperial powers. And so one of the results of the constitution implementing equal rights for all citizens was that the various small privileges that particular national minority groups had within the Ottoman Empire were ended. Of course, these reforms failed to stop the demise of the Ottoman Empire, whose military alliance with Germany resulted in them being dragged into the First World War. France and Britain carved up the Middle Eastern provinces of the Empire, and Britain occupied Istanbul from 1919 to 1923, while the Greek army, which had not fought in the war, then pursued a war against the remnants of the Ottoman army under Ataturk. The European powers had no appetite to continue fighting, and Ataturk managed to rally the nation to defeat Greece. He wasn't obviously called Ataturk at this point. I think only in 1934 did he take on the name when the surname law came in. So at this point, everybody would have been calling him Mustafa Kemal Pasha, I suppose. Ataturk left in undisputed control of Anatolia, used his power to complete the reforms initiated by the CUP in the second constitutional period. Some of these reforms were not popular with the mass of Turkish citizens, but they were passed anyway by the Grand National Assembly, which was completely under Ataturk's control, and Turkey became a republic on October 29, 1923. The capital was also moved to Ankara, which was unpopular with people in Istanbul, especially civil servants. Early disputes about issues like this in the new republic led to the People's Party splitting into the Republican People's Party and Progressive People's Party, a faction which was later suppressed by Ataturk. The government pushed its reforms further, closing down religious shrines and dervish convents, banning the fez, adopting the European calendar and a penal code inspired by Mussolini's Italy. The Sharia was also abolished. However, like the Young Turks before them, the Kemalists never used their power to reform socio-economic relations. There was no attempt to reform land or economic ownership of capital. Women were given the right to vote in 1934, but at this point, democracy in Turkey was still a facade tightly controlled by the army. The press was tightly controlled, and a Kurdish rebellion in 1925 led to martial law being imposed after 1929, and draconian restrictions on Kurdish identity were put in place. After the Second World War, Turkey began to democratise further, and the CHP lost the 1950 election to Adnan Menderes's Democratic Party. By 1960, the military was unhappy with the democratic experiment, and Menderes's growing authoritarianism, and decided to remove him in a coup, inaugurating the Second Republican period. A group of Istanbul University law professors were tasked with writing a new constitution. This was very different from the 1924 constitution, and attempted to prevent one party monopolising power, as the Democratic Party had done. An independent constitutional court was introduced, and the judiciary, universities, and mass media were guaranteed autonomy. This opening up led to a period which coincided with dramatic levels of economic growth and the movement of more people from rural to urban areas. It also created a polarized political landscape where left and right-wing organizations clashed in the streets, unions advocated for higher wages, and political murders became commonplace. In 1971, the military gave the Demirel government an ultimatum demanding reforms. Demirel stepped down and the army installed a government led by CHP member Nihat Erim, who proposed changes to the constitution to make it less liberal. Civil liberties were limited, the autonomy of universities and the press was ended, as were the powers of the constitutional court. Special state security courts were instituted, which tried more than 3,000 people before they were abolished in 1976. However, political chaos continued with Demirel and Ecevit governments both losing their majorities when coalition partners defected. The system became paralysed because Demirel's CHP and Ecevit's Adalet Party, Justice Party, were unable to cooperate after 1973. The weakness of the state encouraged political violence, such as the murder of over 34 left-wing demonstrators on May 1, 1977, when right-wing terrorists opened fire on crowds in Taksim Square. The military once again started preparing to intervene. The 1980 coup went much further in changing the political system than previous coups had done, though the politicians who were tried by the military administration, the Islamist Erbakan and the ultranationalist Türkeş, were eventually released after not guilty verdicts at their trials. However, up to 122,000 people were arrested, including many members of Türkeş's street gangs, the Grey Wolves, and many people who had simply expressed vaguely leftist views. A consultative assembly was convened in 1981, with members appointed by the military. It elected a 15-member constitutional committee, which produced a draft constitution in 1982. This document was, according to Zurcher, in many respects a reversal of the constitutional developments of 1960. It concentrated power in the executive, increased the powers of the president and National Security Council, abolished the Senate, limited freedom of the press, the freedom of trade unions to strike, and the rights of individuals. The constitution was put to a referendum where voting was mandatory and all criticism of the constitution was banned. It passed, of course, by 91.4%. The 1982 constitution has been amended 17 times since it was made law. This was done for various purposes, including to reduce the voting age, bring Turkey into line with EU laws, and most recently in 2017 to approve the change to an executive presidential system which has allowed Erdogan to retain his primary position at the top of the Turkish political system. This referendum also made other changes, like increasing the number of parliamentary seats from 550 to 600. This background should show that the constitution of Turkey is quite changeable and it doesn't prove a huge obstacle to a powerful Turkish executive to change it for whatever purpose it wants. So, on to the question of whether the constitution allows Erdogan to run for a second term. The answer is pretty simple. It kind of does. Although Article 101 states that the president of the republic's term of office shall be 5 years, a person may be elected as the president of the republic for 2 terms at most. Article 116 also states that if the assembly decides to renew the elections during the second term of the president of the republic, he or she may once again be a candidate. So the assembly needs a 3/5 majority in order to call early elections. The AKP don't have a majority at the moment, but they could try another argument to get the constitutional court to accept early elections. According to Balkan Insight, the AKP argue that Erdogan's second term is in fact his first, since it's the first under the new presidential system instituted in 2017. It seems like kind of a flimsy argument, and Balkan Insight states that most experts reject this, saying that the constitution was only amended, not renewed. So unless Erdogan uses the argument that this is his first term in office, he can't run again in 2023, unless the assembly calls an election before then. The other option, of course, is a constitutional referendum, again, to extend the president's term limit. Erdogan is good at winning constitutional referendums, as he did in 2017, by quite a narrow margin, and this is exactly what Putin did in 2018 to give himself 2 more 6-year terms as president. Whatever option Erdogan chooses, it would seem unlikely that he wants to step down in 2023, given that it's the 100th anniversary of the founding of the Republic of Turkey. So, what's going to happen? To answer these questions, we're going to be speaking to Emre Turkut, an expert on the Turkish legal system at the University of Ghent in Belgium, where he's doing his PhD. So, welcome to Emre Turkut, who is a PhD researcher at the University of Ghent. You were quoted in the Balkan Insight article that I have just mentioned. Hopefully you can give us some insight into how the constitution works, what it allows, and what the possibilities of changing it are if the AKP decides to do that. So welcome, Emre, and thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
So first of all, as I've already just talked about, the Constitution requires that the Assembly has to agree to early elections. Obviously, the AKP, along with their MHP coalition partners, don't have a 3/5 majority in the Assembly at the moment. So for the Assembly to agree to early elections, presumably it would need at least some support from CHP. So first of all, do you think that the CHP would agree to early elections? And why would they not try to block early elections if it could force some kind of governmental crisis where the AKP would be forced to look like it's breaking the constitution?
Well, let me first try to give some basics, right? I mean, Recep Tayyip Erdoğan was elected as president in 2014, and in 2018 he was elected to the same position for a second term. To the Turkish constitution, in fact, you know, it is clear in its command that no one may serve as president for more than two terms. But the question arises whether this is the last term of President Erdoğan in office. The short answer is maybe, but a definite yes answer to that question is quite impossible because there will be some creative interpretations of the Turkish constitution. This is mostly due to the exception regulated in Article 116 of the Turkish Constitution. And that exception, as you said, concerns renewal of elections. And the first and third paragraph of that article basically states that the Turkish parliament may renew elections. This means in practice that the parliament will dissolve itself together with the presidency, and new parliamentary and presidential elections will be held. Only in that case, President Erdoğan can run for a third term as president. But as you just mentioned, the parliamentary decision requires a 3/5 majority, which means that 360 MPs out of 600 will have to vote in favor of the early elections. So the problem is that the People's Alliance, I mean, in Turkish Cumhur İttifakı, Erdoğan's AKP and Bahçeli's MHP currently have 340 MPs, so they would need around further 20 MPs from opposition parties. Whether this bill will be supported or this decision will be supported by opposition parties is not clear. But as far as I know, the CHP are giving increasingly mixed signals. The party leader, for example, Kemal Kılıçdaroğlu, is seeming a positive on that. But the party leadership take a very firm negative stance. Whether this will be a politically right or wrong step to take, we will all have to wait and see. But if the CHP agrees to, you know, early elections, I don't think this would be surprising, because since 2016 they have adopted increasingly conflicting policies. The 2017 constitutional amendments, I think, provides a very, salient example here, because in the Constitution Committee deliberations of the constitutional amendment in Parliament, the CHP took a very, critical stance. They argued that this amendment, provides a clear violation of the Turkish Constitution, and this gave appearance that the CHP would, have lodge and a petition to the Turkish Constitutional Court. But then, they very surprisingly decided not to take amendment to the court. Instead, they appealed to quote unquote the nation's or the people's justice. And the appeal to the people instead of the court, for example, has led us to, observe that the CHP is quite desperate of any prospect of success of today's, Turkish political climate or political institutions.
What would be the reason why CHP or some members of the CHP might support an early election? What would they benefit from doing that?
Well, I mean, these requires an understanding of the, you know, post-coup period in Turkey. As you know, in the post-coup period since 2016, the AKP government and the Turkish government become increasingly authoritarian, and after the 2017 constitutional amendments, there is a new political regime in place in Turkey. What they can gain from it, I'm not sure, because as I said, it would require a closer look at the, you know, Turkey's institutions in the post-coup period. The Turkish government become increasingly authoritarian, and then basically the CHP or the any other opposition parties lost their hope in trying to, you know, put, for example, the Turkish state institutions back into line with democratic values.
But this seems like an obvious way that the CHP could force a kind of to force the AKP into making a decision that could potentially look really bad for them. You know, that if the constitution says that Erdogan cannot run for another term, and then he's forced to either try to go for another referendum, and if he wanted to have another referendum to change the constitution, what majority would it require to have a new referendum? Say for example, like yesterday I suggested that, you know, Erdogan has been saying for a long time, if the Turkish people want the death penalty back, you know, we should have the death penalty back. So, you know, for example, if he decided to have a referendum on both the death penalty and on, say, removing the term limits or giving the president another two terms, which is what Putin did in Russia in 2018, that might be quite a clever way to force a referendum on something that's potentially popular with the Turkish people, the bringing back the death penalty, and something that's potentially not that popular, extending the term limits. But putting them both together would give him quite a good chance of winning them both at the same time. I mean, do you think that that's something that they could try to do, or what majority would they need in the assembly to have another constitutional referendum?
Well, the Turkish constitution adopted by a military rule in 1982 so far has been amended 19 times, and the first being in 1987 and the last in 2017. So we definitely, as you said, you know, have to take have to take notice of the frequency within which the Turkish constitution has been amended. And against that background, I think we all have to acknowledge that a constitutional amendment aiming to perpetuate, for example, Erdogan's presidency or evade the term limits may be an option. But whether this is a politically more viable route for AKP or People's Alliance, I'm not sure, because a constitutional amendment will still require a 3/5 majority of the parliament to be put forward to a referendum and a 2/3 majority to be ratified directly. And it will, in that case, it will eventually call for an intervention by the Turkish Constitutional Court, because I'm sure the opposition parties would like to take the amendment to the court. So in essence, I think such a constitutional amendment aiming to perpetuate Erdogan's presidency would result in clear contradiction with the principles of democracy, rule of law, and human rights. And I don't think the Turkish Constitutional Court might be in a position to tolerate or justify it, even though the Constitutional Court faces some direct limitations on its independence and on its power since 2010.
I have noticed that there were a couple of incidents recently in which AKP politicians criticized the Constitutional Court. Mm-hmm. Süleyman Soylu, I think the other day, he complained that the Constitutional Court it cancelled his ban on protest marches. Mm-hmm. So Soylu actually compared the judges on the Constitutional Court to the judges that sentenced Menderes and Socrates, which is, you know, obviously incredibly hyperbolic, because you know, he's still the interior minister of Turkey. He's not, you know, on an island prison about to be executed by a military coup. So I just wonder, is there anything, you know, that shows that the Constitutional Court still has some level of independence from the government. But I wonder whether those kind of attacks by people like Soylu indicates that the government might take further steps to limit the independence of the court.
Again, I have to, you know, give some background to it, because as you might be aware, you know, especially from 2010 onwards, the AKP adopted a whole set of measures to control and contain the Turkish court, constitutional court, judicial activism. In the 2010 constitutional amendments, for example, the entire structure of the court was changed. The judicial appointments, for example, were you know, highly centralized, and these enabled the AKP, the ruling AKP, to make some worldly political appointments to the court, and this led many, you know, scholars and policymakers to, you know, argue that the Turkish constitution to the Turkish constitutional court was packed. Again, in the, you know, 2017 constitutional amendments, only some minor changes were made. For example, the changes reduced the number of Turkish constitutional court judges from 17 to 15, but the vast appointment powers of the president in the new system, you know, has already had some direct consequences for the court's institutional independence. And as a result, apart from one member, all members currently serving on the court have been directly appointed by President Erdogan, President Gül, or by the parliament under AKP's control. If I am to give an example, for example, President Erdogan's appointments in 2019 is rather striking in that sense, because Erdogan appointed Yıldız Seferinoğlu and Selahattin Menteş, and these two individuals both served as deputy minister of justice in the AKP government. So one can argue that these political appointments produce a remarkably ideologically split court. But apart from these judicial appointments, the court also faced some, as I mentioned, faced some direct and perhaps more acute limitations on its power and independence. For example, direct attacks and public campaigns has long been part of the Turkish government's rhetoric against the court. And as things stand, the court, the Turkish Constitutional Court, is ultimately contained within an increasingly authoritarian political system in Turkey. And as you just mentioned, this is more recently exemplified by the statements of Interior Minister Soylu and maybe most recently by Bahçeli targeting the court.
Yeah, I saw his statement. I saw his statement reported, but it didn't seem clear exactly what kind of reforms he wants to be made. I mean, I wonder also, you know, that. You know, one of the other big stories at the moment that's happening in Turkey with regards to the law is the social media law that's seeking to force social media companies to appoint representatives in Turkey. I know that law also is something that has been championed by the MHP, and sometimes I've heard people saying that the MHP has quite a lot of control over the legislative agenda of the government at the moment, because the AKP really needs their support in order to pass legislation, because it doesn't have an absolute majority. So, you know, if so, first of all, I guess, what changes do you think Bahçeli and the nationalists would like to make to the Constitutional Court? And do you think that they want those changes so much that they would try and force it onto the legislative agenda, or is this just kind of you know, fantastical thinking, and that's not actually going to happen?
Well, I will have to respond to that question with a counter question, John, because the question is what more they can do. Because as I said, the president has some vast appointment powers in judicial appointments to the Constitutional Court. In the new system, the president can appoint 12 court judges out of 15, and three can be appointed by the by simple majority by the parliament. So I mean, they have every power to do, you know, do the judicial, to make the judicial appointments as long as it pleases them. And the next step would be to, you know, eliminate the whole power of the Turkish Constitutional Court and try to create a new constitutional court, for example, as Bahçeli suggested. But again, this would have some, you know, broader consequences in terms of Turkey's, you know, commitment to human rights, the commitments to rule of law.
Do you think that, I mean, this is perhaps a broader question that's harder to answer, but do you think that the Turkish public would get annoyed if the government tried to change the constitution to allow Erdogan to run for two or three more terms? Or do you think that AKP supporters would obviously like that, but that the average Turkish person wouldn't care that much, considering that the constitution has been changed so often? I wonder, you know, if a lot of people would see this as just another small legal change, or would this be like actually something that a lot of people would protest over, would, you know, would really get them angry that the you know, some of the fundamental aspects of the Turkish constitution, the commitment to liberal democracy, for example, seems to be being reduced with these kind of amendments?
Well, just to reiterate, I don't think the People's Alliance would adopt a constitutional amendment, because as I said, it would eventually call for intervention by the Turkish Constitutional Court and is somehow politically risky. So what I think the AKP and the MHP will do is they will try some political avenues. For example, the renewal of elections by the Turkish parliament would be, you know, such an option. So I think definitely the AKP and MHP will try to, you know, use politically more viable routes to evade the term limits, so to say.
Do you think that if they manage to convince enough CHP lawmakers to support having an early election, that would cause some kind of fundamental split within the CHP between the members who are a bit more willing to go along with what the government wants to do in return for whatever, and deputies who are less willing to agree with AKP on anything?
Well, the CHP might agree to, you know, early elections, not just because it would evade the two term limits for President Erdogan, but due to, for example, economic woes of Turkey. And that might be an option if they are to, you know, agree to snap elections, because the Turkish economy is dramatically growing, so to say. And the only option, and again, let me just rephrase it. The CHP, for example, and okay, I'll just try to. because I like to make I like to stress their somewhat populist policies. Let me put it that way. So in 2019, as you know, the opposition party, the CHP, got the mayorship in three biggest cities of Turkey. And for example, Ekrem İmamoğlu can be seen as a very, you know, as a very good candidate for the 2023 elections. So the opposition policies are getting, you know, gaining tractions with the public. In that case, I think the CHP thinks that, you know, they have a very large electoral support. And this may be the second option why they would agree to early elections.
Do you think that there's the other reason that they might agree is just to avoid a confrontation with the AKP? Because if there isn't early elections, then AKP will have to do something more drastic in order to ensure that Erdogan can still be a candidate. I mean, they might have mm-hmm. to, you know, claim that it's only his first term, or mm-hmm. I don't know what else they could do. But like, you can see that if the economy keeps on going in the direction it's going now, mm-hmm. 2023 is the 100th anniversary of the founding of the Turkish Republic. That's going to be a very important year for the Turkish government. It's not a year that they want to have a huge political crisis. So I just wonder if that both the AKP and the CHP might agree to early elections just in order to avoid some kind of huge political crisis and confrontation within the anniversary year of the Turkish Republic.
Well, I mean, that might be the case, because the regular elections is expected to take place in, you know, 2023, which is over 2 years from now, but the battle is already brewing on. And I'm sure it'll get messier in the near future. But much will depend on whether the AKP's arguments in favor of early elections to give Erdogan the longest time in office will gain any traction with the public. So they will first, I think, try to popularize their interpretation of constitution, and they will try to use some politically more viable routes. Given the policies, the AKP's policies their populist authoritarian policies, I think they would want to, you know, take it to the public, not to opposition parties. I mean, they only need 20 MPs. If you do the math, they will only need 20 parties. And eventually they might need CHP, for example, because Meral Akşener's E Party has, as far as I know, over 40 MPs. And Akşener, even though she lost her ideological affiliation with the MHP, she's giving, you know, she said she might be cooperative. But, she has a condition in that sense. She wants the old parliamentary system in Turkey, and that would be her only condition.
Can you explain a bit more about what she, when you say she wants the old parliamentary system?
So, as you know, since 2017, she has been fiercely opposing to the new presidential system. And as far as I know, a few months ago, she said that she might be cooperative, meaning that she might agree to early elections and vote in favor of elections on the condition that the People's Alliance would bring the old parliamentary system back.
But it doesn't seem to me like that has a chance of happening, because why would the AKP and MHP just give up the changes that they made just a few years ago, which again cements Erdogan's position at the top of Turkish politics? He's not going to want to do that.
Well, I mean, this is not an easy question to answer directly, because we will have to, you know, take a look at, you know, political climate in that term. But to be honest, the new system provides double jeopardy system in every aspect. For example, let's think that if the People's Alliance or AKP loses its majority in the parliament, then what would happen? Because in this new system, we can't speak of a separation of powers. Because we might, to some extent, you know, speak of a unification of powers, because Erdogan is the head of executive, and his party has the majority in the parliament. And what if this political climate changes, right, Jan?
I mean, that's, we have no idea how, you know, what's going to happen at the next election. You know, if, for example, the HDP might slip under 10%, or the party might be banned, you know, then those seats might go to the AKP, and that would increase, you know, their chance of having an overall majority again, even if their public support decreases. So it's, yeah, it's, you know, when you read about Turkish history, parliamentary and constitutional history, when you look at what happened in the 60s and 70s, you know, it's interesting to me that the current way that the Turkish parliament and constitution is organized, the part of the point of the 1980 coup was to have a stronger executive, and now we have an even stronger executive in the Turkish presidential system, and yet the AKP is still not really able to have complete control over the system. You know, that there's still a level of, to some extent, competitive authoritarianism is what people call Turkey a lot of the time.
There are still elections, even though we have concerns about its fairness, whether we can trust it, but there are still elections in Turkey. But being a democracy is much more than that. So being a democracy requires a full commitment to human rights, to the principles of rule of law, democracy. So being a ballot box, but it would make you, you know, categorically and theoretically a competitive authoritarianism, but also some scholars also argue that, you know, Turkey has turned into a full authoritarian system.
Well, I think that
distinction between that is not clear.
Yeah, I think that that's why this question about what it's possible to do under the current constitution and whether some of the fundamental aspects of that constitution could be changed is quite an interesting question, because it does strike me that Turkey is moving towards some kind of critical political point where some kind of change is going to happen, whether that's you know, a fundamental change to the constitution, whether that's some kind of split within the AKP that results in Erdogan losing his power, because in general the way that governments change in Turkey is that whoever is the governing authority, they tend to split into one or two directions, and then one of those directions will be the next government. So It strikes me that the next government of Turkey is likely to come from a faction within the AKP, but what faction that is it's hard to tell at the moment, and it's hard to tell, you know, what any other kind of change to the constitution, what effect that would have on the AKP, or what effect that would have on the relationship between the AKP and the other parties in the assembly. We can all play like hypothetical history and think about, you know, what various changes would lead to, but it's very difficult to tell, you know, at the moment what's going to happen before 2023. Certainly it does seem that if there's another election, I don't see how the AKP will continue to get the number of votes that they're getting now. I mean, we all know when we speak to friends in Turkey, that there are lots of people who, you know, even traditional AKP supporters who are looking at the economy and wondering if there's somebody else that they could vote for. I think I can see why the CHP might want to have another election, and why they also might want to avoid having a really direct confrontation about the constitution, you know, if it gets to 2023 and there's not a change, because you can guarantee that the AKP will try to have Erdogan as the presidential candidate again. It seems inevitable to me.
Exactly. And the wisest, the political step for the CHP to take would be to wait until 2023 and see what goes on, I think. That would be the wisest thing.
That's what I would do if I was Kemal Kılıçdaroğlu. But, you know, who knows? Who knows what he's thinking? I'm not sure that, you know, a lot of other people in the CHP, you know, particularly know what the leadership of the CHP is going to do about this.
So, exactly. For the past, you know, 10 for the past 20 years, I think the CHP hasn't ruled the country. So the CHP was part of coalition governments, but in terms of having the majority in the parliament, for example, they haven't ruled the country. So, since 2019, especially the landslide victory of Ekrem İmamoğlu, who seems to be a good candidate for president, I think they might want to hold offices as soon as possible because they think that they have this electoral support, and they are also tightening their commitments to so-called secular nature of the state, and they're becoming they're trying to adopt policies in favor of the people, let's say.
At the same time, it does strike me that the CHP needs to maintain a kind of a perception of being nationalistic enough. Because obviously the CHP is vulnerable to criticism by the AKP that they're too secular, from a sort of religious point of view, they often get criticized for being the party of the Alevis as well. They're a party that's kind of hostile to religious people. I mean, that's the argument that the AKP often uses. So it strikes me in a way that maybe Mansur Yavaş, the mayor of Ankara, might be a better candidate for the CHP than İmamoğlu, just because his background is a bit more nationalistic. I think he used to be in the MHP, and perhaps that he can carry some of those religious nationalist voters away from AKP, MHP, EU party, and towards the CHP in a way that maybe less nationalistic, less, more secular candidates can't do. I mean, I know that İmamoğlu does make a political point about his religiosity. Although I think some people also say that his wife looks quite secular. So maybe that, I don't know if that plays against him, but I think it will be really interesting to see what happens at the next election in Turkey. I hope it would be interesting as a journalist. It would be interesting to be there and cover what's happening or what will happen there in the run up to the election.
I wish you good luck.
Thanks very much. Thanks very much for talking to me today. It's been really interesting, and it's useful to have the expertise of somebody who is working on Turkish law as their career, I suppose. So thank you very much, Emre. Good luck in your continuing PhD. And it'll be very interesting to see what happens over the next year or so in regards to whether Tayyip Erdogan is going to be president again after 2023.
Thank you, John. Thanks for having me.
Thanks very much. Goodbye. Ahval podcastlerini tüm mobil telefon. You can follow Ahval News Online podcast series through Apple Podcasts, Spotify, YouTube, Google Podcasts, SoundCloud, and Spreaker. All you need to know about Turkey is here, for your ears, mind, and attention. Thank you for listening to our podcast.